What is going on, guys? Welcome back, slash welcome to Primal Alchemy's Red Pill Initiation Hour, here with your host, Chris Story. Few updates just to get everyone in alignment and on the same wavelength here for everyone that's new to this and for the returning guests. I just want to give my thanks to each and every one of you for tuning into this episode, prior and present. It really does mean the world to me, guys. Honestly, it really does. And yeah, I'm super grateful for the position that I'm in at the moment, being able to do these podcasts, talk to people who I've looked up to for the majority of my adolescence into the young adult life, and being able to share that conversation with you. And not only just sharing it with you, but sharing it in a way that allows you to benefit, allows you to gain value and progress in your own life and your own journey. And this is massive for me. You're allowing me to live my dream, which is to wake the world up, save myself, save the world in the process. And by doing that, lead in a way that you guys can find inspiration and motivation from, and save yourself and save the world in the process. We're all on this journey together, so I just want to give a massive thank you. I have been reading a lot of the reviews that's been left on iTunes recently, which is amazing. So please, if you like this episode, you like any of the episodes prior and you haven't done yet, please drop me a review on iTunes, on Apple Podcasts. That is the best way for me to be able to get this podcast out and increase the visibility and exposure of the show to a wider audience and give them the opportunity to be able to listen to subjects that you're just not going to hear about on most conventional podcasts, be that health and fitness, be that nutrition, be that on, you know, biohacking, spirituality podcasts. Like, I'm trying to do something different here because this is the next level. This is the shit. This is the science of ascension. And this is more than just getting some nootropics down your throat so that you've got more acetylcholine production so that you can work harder in the day. This is more than just learning the best diet so that you've got more power output so you can bench a heavier weight. This is about ascension. This is about fulfilling destiny. And I know that you guys are into that. And that is everything. So thank you very much for your time. And as a give back, I always throw you guys an exclusive 10% discount code at primalalchemy.co.uk. So that's going to be the code REDPILL. That's the code REDPILL that when used at checkout, you'll get 10% off anything within your shopping basket. So if you're brand new to the Primal Alchemy brand, guys, and it's the first time you're tuning in, first time that you're being introduced to the brand, then check it out, primalalchemy.co.uk. We've got our Vitruvian protein, which is our flagship organic whey protein superfood blend. It's the only product on the market to be certified organic, keto and paleo approved, made here exclusively in the UK. I source all the ingredients myself. You have full label disclosure so you can see exactly the full formula of how much each ingredient is in. And then on top of that, you can then track that ingredient back to its origin. There's no one else that's doing this shit. We also have our Primal Charity donations, which a percentage of our sale profits goes towards a few NGOs that lie very close to my heart that I've been wanting to work with. One of those being Vitamin Angels. And Vitamin Angels deliver critical nutritional aid, supplement support to malnutrition children around the world. Malnutrition families in third world countries. And it really, it's another way that allows me to really help the world by you directly helping me. Did that make sense? I don't know. It sounded right in my head when I was saying it. So anyway, guys, check that out and see what you think. Other than that, guys, moving on to today's episode. This one's gonna be another interesting one, probably something that you guys haven't heard of before. So today's guest is Dr. Mauro Zapatera. So Mauro is an MD. He attained his MD and PhD from Harvard Medical School. So quite the name on today's show, guys. Quite the big deal indeed. And basically, Morrow's work is all about working with neuronal stem cells. And what's really interested me in his work was his work was his focus on the cerebral spinal fluid. So you guys may have heard me discuss before the whole sort of pathway of the 33 vertebrae in rising your kundalini energy up the 33 vertebrae through the fourth and third ventricle into the pineal gland, secrete the DMT and initiate God mode. So again, that's not just me saying that. There is some credible science and legit research that shows the effect that cerebral spinal fluid has on the body. And this is the medium in which that charge, that spiritual charge, is held and transferred within. And Dr. Morrow's done some amazing work concerning this. And he's also, as well as being like an MD, PhD, if that wasn't enough, he's also a trained practitioner in polarity therapy, Reiki, cranial sacral therapy. Fuck, he's done it all, man. He's a really interesting guy. So me and him went deep for sure on this one. I really hope you enjoy it. Please let myself and Morrow know how you get on afterwards. And yeah, as always, you know the deal by now. Morpheus, tell these fools what's up.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
As above, so below, what lies without resides within. Time for growth to begin. Mental, physical, and spiritual, we find balance with all three as we focus on totality, the whole, not the half. This is for those on a spiritual path, looking for the clues to the answers of life. But the truth ain't always nice, so leave your ego at the door. Let your inner lion roar and your spirit soar as we go deep down to the molecular level. Tap into the body with some yogic breath. Throw in some calisthenics for a true strength test. Like the shamans of old, we use a nature to heal with a little bit of DMT to reveal. This whole life journey is a little surreal, and your mind needs a leader, not a follower in life. Let your mind be the master and you pay a hefty price. This next 60 minutes is about self mastery. It's not an easy path and it's a lifelong journey, but we up to empower with this red pill initiation hour. With this red pill initiation hour, brought to you by Primal Alchemy.
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Three, two, one, and oh shit, guys, we are back. Praise Odin. Episode 48 of the Red Pill Initiation Hour, and we're coming in hot with this one, guys. This one, we are going Morrow. Did you like that one, Morrow? Fuck. That's the kind of thing that we've got on here, man. You know, we're going to be pretty chilled. So anyway, guys, kicking off today's episode, we got a pretty amazing guest on. We're going to be going deep down the rabbit hole, but we're going to be having some fun along the way. This is, as you know by now, we're pretty informal on this podcast, and we just want to have a good time and get woke as fuck in the process. So, today's episode is going to be pretty deep, guys. This is one that you guys know by now my sort of views on essentially how to become a god, guys. We want to release that DMT in the brain, and there's certain mechanisms that are involved in the whole ascension process, the whole path of enlightenment. And today's guest is someone who's put in the work, talks the talk and walks the walk, and I've loved his work for a while. I've watched a lot of his content on science and non-duality, which is a really cool YouTube channel that is like a conference that a lot of alternative thinkers that are thought leaders within their field speak at. And today's guest has spoken there a few times. So yeah, I just want to give a massive warm welcome to Dr. Morrow Zapatera. Morrow, thanks for coming on, man. Yeah, you have me cracking up there as well, dude.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Awesome introduction. I'm happy to be part of the reptile initiation process.
Yes, I see the depths that this is going to already. This one is going to be definitely getting us noted on the NSA's database. We're going to be triggering a few of the CIA's. Okay, sound. So Morrow, man, For everyone that's not familiar with who you are and what you're about, could you give us a little bit of a rundown about your work and what you sort of specialize in? Because it is it's quite a niche subject, but one that once you understand it, it really does connect a lot of other what you would think as a beginning sort of unconnecting points. And this really is like the cement that glues it all together.
Yep. So for my day job, let's say I'm a physician and I do physical medicine rehabilitation. And one of the things that I work at, I work with people who have chronic pain from anything that life essentially has thrown at them. And what we do is we actually created a multiple programs for people who have chronic pain, and they're multidisciplinary programs. So we actually integrate lecturers, we integrate pain psychologists, we integrate physical therapists, we integrate occupational therapists. And we really try to help people manage their pain non-pharmacologically. We help people manage their pain by themselves, sort of heal thyself, if you would say. We teach them about an anti-inflammatory diet. We teach them about mindfulness, meditation, you know, ways of modulating their pain response as opposed to always having to go to the medication. And so that's what I do sort of in my day job. To get here, I also have a profound interest on the cerebrospinal fluid. And in terms of getting here, so I went to Harvard Medical School and I did an MD PhD at Harvard Medical School. So I took 9 years or so to complete that. And in the process, I was always interested in, you know, I knew I was going to medical school. And so I knew that I was going to get sort of the Western way of anatomy and physiology, right? I was going to get those classes. I was going to get pharmacology. I was going to get anatomy. We're going to do cadaver labs and stuff. And I was always interested in other things like acupuncture, Chinese medicine, meridians. When people talked about meridians, what are those? And so I had a couple people sort of hand me different books along the way, and I was always interested in things. And I particularly remember reading a book called Anatomy of the Spirit by Carolyn Mace as I was flying from California to Boston for medical school. You know, kind of trying to get a sense. She was sort of became a medical intuitive and worked with some pretty prominent physicians, being able to diagnose cancers that hadn't been seen on scans before. And was actually working closely with physicians to help patients not only diagnoses, but also heal. And so I was interested in understanding various views of how the body, you know, how people looked at the body. It wasn't just bones, skin, you know, fascia, blood vessels, that there was something else that was actually informing the body. So I entered medical school with sort of that vision. I went through 2 years. The way that it's set up is you go through 2 years of medical school, and then you put that off to the side and you start doing research. And then you do anywhere between, let's say, 3 to 6 years of research, depending on how long your PhD takes you. And during that time period, I was actually doing cancer biology because I thought I wanted to do cancer. And I met my now wife, who looked at me and she's like, you don't look too happy doing what you're doing, sort of thing. Why don't we rethink this whole thing? And I was like, what do you mean, rethink this whole thing? I definitely sort of have a resistant nature. You know what I mean? Here I am, I got to do this, right? And so with gentle and subtle guidance from her, essentially, she wanted to study some sort of holistic health system. She was thinking of possibly doing naturopath. And then, you know, she just Googled, I think, you know, some Googled like holistic health system, and this thing popped up, polarity therapy, for her. And she was doing all this research on it. She's like, let's go to Santa Fe. Let's take some time off of your PhD and let's go to Santa Fe and study polarity therapy. And I looked into it, and I'm like, wow, you know, that actually looks pretty neat. And, you know, I was thinking I was just going to get an extended break from my PhD work. And she's like, no, I want you to do the class with me.
It's like, fuck. Exactly. Yeah, I can't get out of this one.
No, you're doing with this. And I'm like, all right, well, I think there's a short version, right, of it. And and there was. And she's like, all right, look, do the short version, then we'll talk about doing the long version. And, you know, in the middle of the short version, I'm like, okay, well, you're going to continue doing the long version. I'm going to stop at the short version. She's like, no, you're doing the long version with me, too.
Yes, all right. Oh, okay. Guess I am. Fuck. There goes the PhD. Put that on hold for a little bit.
And so, we started studying polarity therapy together, and it was probably, you know, it was sort of like, in retrospect, but I could feel it when I was there too. It was sort of like a really amazing experience for both of us. One of the things we joke about is like, if you're having any marital issues or want to like, you know, deal with like relationship, go to like an energy healing class together, right, with your partner. Stuff is just gonna come up. You know, you don't even know that stuff. Nothing's wrong, and then all of a sudden something bubbles up, and we sort of think that it created the foundation for our relationship. In terms of, you know, now we're married, we have two kids, and by going through that together, in essence, we were like there was a lot of emotional releases that were occurring during the class, because you'd get sessions almost every day. You were giving sessions, you know, we were just kind of like in this moving energy. And it was amazing, right? So we kind of set this foundation on this sort of like energetic relationship as we were developing our own relationship. At the same time, we had to make some money. So we worked at Trader Joe's in Santa Fe, which is also another fascinating experience that I can say I actually worked at Trader Joe's in my lifetime. We were doing part of polarity therapy is actually, we had a teacher in there who did some craniosacral therapy and, essentially gentle. All he was teaching us was sort of a gentle palpation of the cranium. And we would have these classes on Fridays where for an hour we'd essentially just do some cranial holds. And it's anything from just like, like if you imagine a cradle, like you're cradling a little baby or you're cradling like a little kitten, you know, in your hand, but somebody's head is in your hand and their feet are away from you. You're just sort of holding their head, seeing what you notice, or, you know, putting your hands on their frontal bone up here and seeing, you know, just really, really gently. You don't want to cause any pressure. You don't want to like induce any like sudden movements or anything like that. And, you know, one of the things he said is, we can actually feel the fluctuations of the cerebrospinal fluid. And I was in medicine. I knew what cerebrospinal fluid was, but I'm like, fluctuations of cerebrospinal fluid. Does this fluid really, you know, does it move? Does it do this? What is the cerebrospinal fluid? Right. And he said something to the extent of, you know, cerebrospinal fluid is like one molecule away from seawater. And I was a skeptic. Like I'm still a skeptic, right? So I want to know, like, that doesn't sound right. That doesn't sound like seawater in our brain, right? Something like let me look at what is actually in the cerebrospinal fluid to see how accurate this guy was in terms of his, you know, his statements. And so I started looking up, you know, cerebrospinal fluid and contents. And I was like, okay, well, there's a lot in the cerebrospinal fluid. There's a lot of proteins and hormones. And so it's probably not one molecule away from ocean water. But, you know, what does this do in essence? And I kind of kept this in the back of my head as I was practicing craniosacral and polarity and understanding and really palpating different fluctuations, different energetic fluctuations or fluid fluctuations in the body that are separate than like your respiratory system or your heartbeat. And I just sort of had this, you know, what is this cerebrospinal fluid? And when I went back, I wanted to go back to finish my PhD. We completed the course. It was a 700-hour course or something like that. I can't remember now. Long time ago. 700-hour course on polarity therapy. We finished that and, we completed the whole thing. We got our certificate and then we went back to Boston. Jeremy set up a small little practice and I went back and was like, look, I'm not doing cancer. I don't, not, don't, that's not like, like, uh, resonating with me right now. And so I started looking for labs that would be open to me investigating different questions about the brain and about, you know, how the brain functions. And I went to this guy's lab, Chris Walsh, who was doing a lot of genetic studies on brain size and was looking at, you know, genes that affected brain size and genes that affected the little folds in the brain, you know, things like that. And you know, so I went to his lab and he's like, look, you know, what you do is you do little short rotations, like 8-week rotations to get a sense if you, you know, how you did, if you liked it, if you didn't like it, if you liked the projects and stuff. And so he had me working with a couple postdocs and I was flipping through some pages of some embryologic anatomy books. And, you know, I was flipping through a page and I see this, it's sort of what's called a coronal section. It's like somebody just took a section of your head like this and it was an embryo. And it was a tiny little embryo, probably, you know, I'm making it bigger, but it was probably like this. And the brain, literally the brain, what becomes the brain was about, I would say probably about 2 or 3 millimeters. Inside, there was this entire space. And I was like, well, there's a lot of space and then there's a brain. So you kind of see the shell, right? So the brain was kind of the shell, goes down and then it connects to the neck and stuff like that. And inside was this space. It was all white because it wasn't filled with anything. It was a section. And inside this space was these, like, what looked like a little, like a cauliflower had been cut. And it was huge. It was like relatively speaking, it was ginormous, right? Compared to what the brain was, tiny little thing, what our thinking brain was going to become, right? And I remember turning to one of the postdocs who was sitting right beside me. And I was like, hey, what is this? And he's like, oh, that's the choroid plexus. And I'm like, choroid plexus, that makes cerebrospinal fluid. He's like, yeah. I'm like, what is the cerebrospinal fluid doing in the embryologic development? Like, I don't know. Provides, you know, buoyancy, nutrients sort of stuff. And I'm like, there is way too much fluid in this brain. And there, that structure is way too large for it just to have some unknown function. You know, everybody studying that tiny little part that becomes the brain, which is obviously important. But when I was in the lab, you know, you start doing things and everybody grows cells. Like in order for you to grow a cell in a lab, 99% of the people out there do it in a petri dish. They do it in a dish. And in that dish, there's liquid medium. There's liquid, fluid. You know, you can't go on long vacations when you're in the lab because you need to change the fluid. You need to wash it out. You need to clean it. You need to add more growth factors to it to keep the cells alive. Otherwise, they die or they differentiate into different cells. So it depends on what cell you're adding, right? And so we would go to, I mean, you'd have to go. Part of your day in the lab was cleaning out the fluid, giving it new fluid, replenishing it, you know, and so all the cells, every single cell that I grew, whether it was a neuronal stem cell or a neuron or an astrocyte or any sort of, or even a cancer cell for that matter, and you were studying that, was always grown in a liquid medium. And so I said, well, the cerebrospinal fluid is the liquid medium for the brain that it's growing in, right? It's being bathed by this by the liquid. What is the liquid that is bathing, what is the liquid that is bathing these cells, this tissue that is growing in the embryo? And that essentially sparked my sort of quest to figure out what the cerebrospinal fluid was doing in the embryo and what the cerebrospinal fluid was doing in the adult. And how at that time, very little research had actually been done on it. I think there may have been only a couple, you know, a handful of papers on embryologic cerebrospinal fluid and even its contents or what it had or had, how it changed with development. And so I just sort of, this was the perfect integration of a a body work question, right? That sort of developed from this guy saying, you know, the cerebrospinal fluid is one molecule away from the ocean water, to palpating, to literally having 700 hours and more, because we had a lot of exercises that we do in personal, you know, you become so interested in this personally that you just want to hold people's heads. You know, they said, look, you want to get a sense of this, go out and just hold people's head for 1,000 hours, 10,000 hours, right? Just get as many people just hold their head for 10,000 hours. And so during lunchtime, we'd eat, you know, we'd eat our peanut butter and jelly sandwich real fast. And then we'd go and just hold head, right? And see, what are you feeling? Just becoming super grounded, like super aware, just trying to like really like change your awareness and being like, okay, I'm grounded. I'm feeling my butt on the chair, feeling my feet on the ground. My thoughts I set aside. So it's like you're sort of in this perfect awareness meditative state while you're still connected to the sensations that are occurring inside of you, not being attached to them or anything like that, while you're still connected to the sensations of any movement that's occurring, whether it's on your hands or any sort of, you know, anything that kind of arises or anything like that. And so this was sort of the perfect time where I could actually do some research on something in a lab, right? You know, he was actually the principal investigator. Chris Wallace was a Howard Hughes investigator. And so he had not only did he have funding from grants from the NIH and stuff like that, but he also had funding from Howard Hughes. And so he had extra money to spend on projects that he thought were interesting. And he chose this to, you know, as a project that he thought was interesting. So it was a blessing in disguise. You know, he supported me tremendously. And you know, we went on this sort of quest of trying to figure out what the embryologic cerebrospinal fluid was doing. And even here, you know, even he has been quoted a couple of times saying, you know, if you think about the cerebrospinal fluid too much, you might get a little bit spiritual, because it's historically, it's sort of been this fluid that people have talked about, like, you know, even Descartes, like the spirit may be in the cerebrospinal fluid. Different humors and things like that in the cerebrospinal. So it's always kind of had an interesting historical view from people, right? And here I am saying, hey, you know, this fluid is actually bathing the brain. It changes over time. It comes in, and you know, we sort of figured out anatomically, nobody was really thinking about this, but anatomically it differentiates from the amniotic fluid. And so when you're in the womb, all right, like if you everybody who's listening was a little baby, right? Was a tiny embryo in the womb of some mom, right? That's just how it happens. And there's a point where you are literally just a mass of cells, right? Like you thinking, believing, all that was just a mass of cells, and you differentiate and you become this sort of three-layered, dude, the cells do their own thing. Right? They have this beautiful intelligence. They do their own thing. They differentiate. They create a cavity. And now you're like a flat sheet, you know, almost like a three-layered cake or a three-layered dip, right? And then all of a sudden, so on one side of the dip, you have this amniotic fluid. And now all of a sudden, you just undergo these movements. These cells start to divide. They start diving in. You start to come up. You start to fold up. Grabs the amniotic fluid, so you're all fluid. You're essentially all fluid. So all that fluid is bathing all those cells, just like I was to grow. If I took that three-layered dip, that three-layered cell, and had to grow it in the lab, I'd have to take it out. Let's say I'd cut it. I'd cut a piece out, and I'd put it in a lab, and I'd put it in a dish, and I'd have to add fluid to it, right? And so that amniotic fluid that's the endogenous fluid that's essentially bathing those cells that's giving it the nutrients. And so we wanted to know what's in that. That's the endogenous fluid that's actually supporting an embryo developing, right? At its earliest stage, what sort of information is in this fluid? And as this amniotic, so that amniotic fluid is coming, you're like in your mom's womb as a three-layered sheet of cells being bathed with this fluid. And then you undergo these changes, invagination, coming up, folding up, fusing. You create this nice, beautiful tube. And now in that tube, now we just call that, we differentiate that, we call that cerebrospinal fluid, because now you're in the middle of the tube. Right? And so, incredible. Like, you just start thinking about this, and it's like, you know, I remember thinking, like, well, you know, where does the cerebrospinal fluid come originally? And it's like, let's, you know, we were looking at like embryologic texts, and it's like, is it really the amniotic fluid? You know, it was just so cool, because it's like, wow, it's the amniotic fluid becomes the cerebrospinal fluid. And then when I left the lab and continued to pursue more of a medical career, less like in the lab doing lab work, there was a postdoc who essentially continued the work and started looking at, you know, how the amniotic fluid changes into the cerebrospinal fluid, and what are some different molecules and signals that may be sent to the brain, to the developing brain, because that entire canal that is formed, that becomes then your spinal cord and your entire brain. So one part of it grows and it undergoes massive cellular proliferation, and it becomes your brain. And then the other part stays and becomes your spinal cord. But even right now, in the middle of your brain, right? Like right in the middle of your brain, like right around here, you have a third ventricle, and then you have lateral ventricles that are on either side. So it kind of looks like looks like this, right? And some people depict it kind of as a bird, because the third ventricle looks like it kind of has a little beak. And then you have a fourth ventricle that goes down into, I guess, sort of like your brainstem, right in front of the cerebellum, which helps with balance and things like that. And then from the fourth ventricle, you go down into your spinal cord, and that's all fluid. So there's all fluid going all the way down the spinal cord. And then on the outside of the brain, you're bathed on the outside of the brain by this fluid, all the way down the outside of the brain, all the way down the spinal cord, and all the way down your sacrum, all the way down to your sacrum, right? Like S2, S3. Sort of, you're sitting right now on a pool of cerebrospinal fluid.
So, I've heard that one of the things, Mara, I heard that you say is that we've, on the average human being's got about 150 milliliters of cerebrospinal fluid in them at any given time. Is that right?
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So 150 mils. I mean, you got 150 mils of this stuff, and, you know, it's a third of a can of Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Or, you know, half, if you're depending on, you know, it could be a third to a half or so. But if you have 300 mils, you know, most people know, I think maybe 300 mils or 350 mils, you know, you're looking at a third to a half of a can of Coca-Cola is in you right now. And you're producing it. You're constantly moving it. You know, it's constantly being resorbed. It's constantly being moved. And now, you know, I follow all the new research and sort of try to integrate it, because I'm not actually doing the lab work right now. I'm working more with people, so I'm trying to sort of do more like you know, meditations and stuff using the cerebrospinal fluid as a guide, and integrating all the new research that comes out, and also just making people aware that we have this fluid, right? Like, there's a fluid in your brain that's actually fairly important. And, you know, one of the things that's kind of, is you make this fluid, so you're constantly changing it, is sleep. So now there's this big thing about sleep, right? Like, somebody actually figured out that they were doing these studies, and they saw that in rats, that when they were unconscious or asleep in an altered state, essentially, that the brain, so at first we thought that the brain was totally separate from this fluid, almost like you'd have the shore, you know, like the coast, and you'd have the ocean, right? And they hit, yeah, we knew that, right? Because we know that there's some receptors on there. We know it hit, But we didn't really think that the ocean would go into the brain, right? That the cerebrospinal fluid would go into the brain. And so what they found out is that during states of sleep, and although this hasn't been proven yet, my hypothesis would be that since sleep is a state of altered consciousness, and you need parasympathetic response. So potentially any other state of deep parasympathetic response, deep relaxation, deep meditation, right? A deep session of craniosacral therapy or any sort of hands-on healing work. That your brain, it almost has these like gates. So if they're closed like this, the fluid can't get in. And then when you're in a deep state of meditation or sleep, we don't know about other states, but sleep for sure, is that you open up these gates, and the fluid now that's in these cavities in your brain now starts seeping through. And what they found is that that actually cleans out your brain.
Shit.
So it goes from a high pressure to a low pressure, and it cleans out. So it's like all the toxins that build up throughout your day through thinking and all that stuff, you know, that the cells kind of spit out, that it cleans it out, essentially cleans it out. And then you wake up, close, and you go about your day, and then you go back to sleep, open, clean it out, close. And so now there's people looking at, wow, you know, I know there's a couple people looking at, you know, for mild cognitive impairment. You know, people are recommending, look, meditate, sleep. Let's try to get these sleep patterns back in. Let's try to work on sleep, not necessarily using, we don't know how, you know, different sleep medications like Ambien or benzodiazepines or stuff that we give for so many people affect these. But looking at, you know, your sleep pattern, your sleep rhythm, you know, looking at other things and trying to really alter sleep mechanisms for people so that they can get that cleaning. They can get that cleaning pattern coming back in. As well as there, I know there's a group who's looking at craniosacral therapy for mild cognitive impairment to see if you can open up the channels in a deep state of relaxation. This is a hypothesis, but they're testing it, you know, just using craniosacral therapy, which is totally safe. And seeing, you know, does the cognitive impairment change at all? And so, you know, so there's so much to this fluid that we're understanding, that we're still learning, that new research is coming out over and over again. And as a method of even communication, right? And so that's kind of one of the things that that I'm looking at. And now, you know, what I do essentially now is I primarily see patients who are in pain, or I also work at the VA, and so I help veterans who are in pain, essentially most of them, because I'm in the field of physical medicine rehabilitation. So we deal with sort of rehabbing people back from any injuries that they may have had, whether it's an amputation, you know, from an IED or diabetes, or just, you know, shoulder pain from repetitive use, from climbing over walls or even typing, you know, because we see all walks, we see active military and non-active and, you know, reserves and all that stuff. So, so that's what I do. And then on my website, holdingspace.com, I put, meditations and other people's experiences of their connection to the CSF, as well as meditations, just bringing people aware that they do have this fluid, in their brain essentially, and it bathes their entire brain. And, you know, even just paying attention to it, what happens to you. So it's kind of what I do.
Yeah, I did one of your guided meditations where you guide the meditation as if it's a first person perspective that you're the cerebral spinal fluid yourself.
Yeah.
And you work your way through the brain, and that was interesting, man. Cause it's like, I was sat there and I was like, okay, I'm going to give this a go. Let's see what Mara's about. And then I was just like, All right, okay. And then you break it down and you're going through the different areas of the brain and you see the corpus callosum and you've got to go through the, like you said, through the ventricle, the third ventricle. And yeah, it was very relaxing. It was different. It was different than what I'm used to when you're doing a form of meditation, which then leads me to ask the question, like, what is your opinion on the purpose of the cerebral spinal fluid when it comes to spirituality? Because you said that when you're doing you can easily be led into a spiritual path through pursuing the research of this. So what is your why do you think that is? Because I know that one of the phrases that you kind of you coin is like the spinal fluid is the embodiment of I am.
Yeah. So, it comes from, personal experience and sort of direct experience, as well as, you know, palpating it, on others and looking at the research. And sort of, you know, it's like what we do is you try to collect, information, right? And then you have a hypothesis, right? Mm-hmm. So essentially my hypothesis based on all the information that I have in terms of the cerebrospinal fluid is what do we know about the cerebrospinal fluid? It's a fluid that exists in your brain. All right. We know that. Okay. It has a huge slew of molecules in it, from proteins to hormones to electrolytes. All right, to signaling molecules. Okay. So when you're growing a tissue, for instance, if you have an embryologic tissue or even a human tissue, you can grow it with cerebrospinal fluid. So it provides nutrients, it provides growth factors, it provides survival factors to the brain.
So it's like the elixir of life.
So it's an elixir of cellular life. That's what we know, right? Like that's been shown in the lab. You can block a certain growth factor and show that it does not, when you add the CSF and you block that growth factor, you don't get as much proliferation. Mm. We've seen that proteins change over time in development. These are things that we've known. We've looked at Western blots. We've looked at very sort of, you know, we've looked at mass spec analysis of proteins, of CSF proteins at different time, and show that there's a different combination of proteins. So that's what we've shown. So essentially, so what does that tell you? What's a signaling? It's a signaling fluid, right? It's providing some sort of signaling to the brain, whether it's biochemical. Fine, right? That's it. Then people have actually looked at, in a study on in rats that because they use their olfactory bulb so much, like their sense of smell, they actually they regenerate the olfactory neurons. And in order to regenerate them, they actually need to send new neurons to that area. Okay. And what they were actually able to show is that by the way that the cerebrospinal fluid pulsated, that the neurons were following the flow of the cerebrospinal fluid out to the nose, out to the olfactory bulb. Hmm. And the information was actually coming from the beating cilia, these beating sort of antenna that were pushing the fluid. That fluid movement then was creating a signal in the brain saying, okay, you guys need to move this way. You guys need to move this way. Not that way, this way, right? And there are mechanoreceptors, meaning you're sensing change in mechanic, change in vibration, change in flow, okay? And so then I see that and I say, wow, that's amazing. There's been some species invertebrates that have actually shown photoreceptors, so they can perceive light, right? So if you have like biochemical receptors, if you have mechanical receptors, and if you have light receptors on the surface of the brain that the CSF is making contact with, then the CSF must be having some sort of ability to transmit that information, right? Whether it's movement, I'm moving my head and my CSF is actually moving inside of me. And maybe it's giving me a sense of, well, I feel a little dizzy. Okay, now my, whatever that might be. Okay. What are the mechanisms? What are the signals that the CSF can actually transmit? And so that's an open question, right? That's still an open question for everybody. And people are investigating this. Like this is an active investigation. And so it is based on my hypothesis, based on my experience of the cerebrospinal fluid, in essence, is that, and all my, and essentially comes from not only the cerebrospinal fluid, but studies of polarity therapy and the studies of energy, right? Is because, you know, I'm a physical body, but there's energy, whether it's from my heart coming out or my brain actually my brain activity right now pulsating. There's energy that's beyond my physical sense, my physical body, right? In polarity and in some other traditions like Tai Chi and things like that, there's a belief that we are essentially energetic beings that are condensed, or we are condensed energy, and so you can see us, right? Like I palpate myself, right? And so in my experience then, in deep states of meditation and from people who have actually contacted me, who have said, wow, this is, you know, this, by you talking about the CSF, you help qualify my experience of what I feel. Like, well, cool. If that helps you. Is that there's a certain energetic field that comes into the cerebrospinal fluid. Okay. And because it's a fluid, you don't need to go through like membranes or walls. Is that it, once it gets in the fluid, it's sort of like you shining a light bulb in the fluid, you're going to light up the fluid like this, right? And so when there's a connection, or when there's an awareness with this connection with the fluid can actually transmit, it's like a transmission of that source energy, boom, to your physical body instantaneously. And so you get this, all of a sudden it just goes, right? And so it's sending a totally synchronous signal. It can send a totally synchronous signal to all the parts of your brain without having to go through synapses and all that other stuff. And so in essence, my belief is that it helps transmit the sense of I am. So when you have that sense of your beingness, like, here I am. This is it.
Yeah.
It most people have this sort of like whole, it's not a, oh, here's my right arm. It's like an entire, like, it's just like, it's, you know, it comes in and it's just like, it's like, whoa, here it is.
So do you think that's related to like the, to like Kundalini rising, things like that? Because that's one of the things that they discuss.
Yeah, so a lot of people say that, you know, for them, exactly. So I've had so many people who have practiced Kundalini contact me and say that's exactly, but I feel it coming up from the sacrum. Like, it's like, I feel this, I literally feel like there is fluid, and they never knew like there was fluid until they listened to my videos, right? And so that's it. It's like bringing that awareness. And now they're working with the fluid, right? So it kind of changes their awareness a little bit, but they feel as if this, there was a rising energy that felt like water was actually moving, coming up. And I have people describe, look, I feel like I can rise it. It rises. And then I feel like it gets stuck like right here, you know? So there's like specific areas where they feel like it gets stuck. And that's where I say, look, have you gotten an MRI of your neck? You know, let's rule out any mass that's causing it to get stuck, right? There could be a mass there that's causing it. Is there any sort of stenosis that's causing, you know, because it's still a, you're now looking at energy, and you're also looking at, you know, it's still, well, is it tight like this, or is it open like this, the canal that it's trying to get through? Because you might actually perceive that, which is why I take people through that cerebrospinal fluid meditation of going through the brain. Because if you do, like, you can actually say, oh, this place, like, it feels like I'm having a hard time going from this place to this place in my own visualization, right? So then you can actually practice that. So what I have is, I actually have people practice, like, try going through it. All right, well, yeah, because I've had neck pain and I got an MRI and it didn't show anything. Great. So now you know, you got an MRI, it didn't show anything. We're not concerned of any infection, any tumor that's compressing on the spinal cord, right? When I make sure that stuff is not there. And then it's sort of like, okay, now let's try to work through these blocks where you feel like the energy is being blocked. Interestingly, you know, a lot of people, when you look at these, you know, when you look at these texts, a lot of people talk about, you know, whether it's a sacred fluid or even, you know, holy oil or, you know, any sort of like stuff like that. And people always relate it back to the cerebrospinal fluid. You know, it's within you. You're, you know, heaven's within you. So it's, so there's this secret, this secretion is actually within you. And so, yeah, so a lot of people contact me in terms of the Kundalini rising. They say, wow, like, I really feel like that's it. Like, I feel like it's the fluid. Now I'm going to start working with the fluid. And, you know, whatever they do, whether it's their movement, whether it's breath work, whether it's chanting, whether it's meditation, you're actually affecting the movement of that fluid. You know, now they're looking at very specific imaging of the fluid moving in between our ventricles. And how, when you inspire, like a deep, like how inspiration and expiration affects the movement between the ventricles, and how certain, you know, certain breathing techniques, for instance, have like intense, like, and they've started looking now at how the cerebrospinal fluid is actually jetting from like the fourth ventricle up to the third ventricle. So in this breath work that people are describing, where they're breathing in, they're inhaling and they're exhaling sort of forcefully, or even some of the work, that Stan Grof does, for instance, with hyperventilation.
Is that like the holotropic breathing?
Exactly. There's some studies that are hinting that actually the cerebrospinal fluid is you're actively being able to move the cerebrospinal fluid between ventricles. They're seeing the movement. They're seeing a high velocity movement between ventricles when you have, you know, I mean, there's a lot of other explanations to his holotropic breathwork, but people have had this experience where they feel like this energy is rising. It's getting stuck in their neck, for instance. They start doing this breathing technique, and then it comes up into their brain. And then they would have what they consider sort of a Kundalini rising, or, you know, they see.
Yeah, like a mystical experience.
Exactly. So I don't know, you know, whenever I say like all I tell people is, look, it's a signaling. We know it provides signaling. If you just want to believe that it's at the biochemical level, sure, because that's we've shown, and the mechanical level. What other signaling? I don't know, but, you know, I do have people contact me who are still, they're constantly doing these experiments. And so it's just, it, you know, it opens up conversation. It's like, oh, wow, well, if it could be doing this, right? It's a hypothesis. It could be doing this. So let's test it. That's it, right? Let's test that hypothesis. And do we have the means to assess it, right? Because that's the other problem, is if you don't have the instruments to assess it. So as time goes on, you know, we've had instruments that now can actually assess fluid movement of the cerebrospinal fluid. We didn't have that 10 years ago. So as new information comes out, it's just going to be fascinating to sort of see how it progresses. I think how the cerebrospinal fluid sort of becomes a field of itself, how people sort of focus not only on their diet and their nutrition and movement and meditation, but also really on their sleep. You know, a lot of people that I consult and that I talk to, you know, they're having some issues with some stuff coming on. The first question I have is, how do you sleep? Horribly. All right. Mm-hmm. Work on that. You know, you can stand upside down and do all this stuff, but if you're not sleeping or having a state in your day where you go into a deep state of meditation or some deep state of subconscious altered state of conscious where you're in a relaxed state, then I don't think that you're actually fully mobilizing your cerebrospinal fluid as much as you could. So that's huge. Sleep is like, you know, or some state, sleep has been shown. So that's why I kind of go back to sleep. My hypothesis again is that other states of deep relaxation or altered states may actually affect that as well. We just don't know that from a quote unquote scientific perspective. But from my perspective, like, I don't stop there, right? Because I don't know how many years I have on this earth, but it goes by fast. And so, you know, I don't have, for myself at least, like, you know, I don't have time to wait for the studies to come out. You know, it's like, let's try it. Let's see if it, do it on yourself, you know? And I'm not talking about doing dangerous things or, you know, where my life is. I'm talking about, you know, changing my sleep patterns, putting my cell phone down at 6 o'clock as opposed to keeping in my head at 10, turning the lights off, you know, like real basic things. So those are the things that I sort of think about.
Yeah, I find that interesting. Like you're saying, that you've said that some of the people that are doing the Kundalini practice, they feel like it gets stopped at the base of their neck.
And yeah.
That's one of the things that it's a lot of these like mystical traditions believe. It's that what you do is, like you said, you're in that deep state of meditation an altered state of consciousness anyway, probably in like an alpha state, maybe a theta state. Yep. And then what happens is that you get that charge. Like you said, how we're like, the way that I look at it, we're almost like the body's a dense shadow of something in the other realm, our true sort of self. And then we can get that energy that's stored within the cerebral spinal fluid, and then it works up the spine. So it works up Jacob's ladder. It works up the 33 vertebrae of the spine, which is what's hypothesized that's why you got the 33rd degree within Freemasonry. That's why Jesus ascended at 33, is that you hit the 33rd vertebrae and then this energy kind of stops, which I believe is at the medulla oblongata. I believe that's where it's meant to stop, which is, and it crucifies the I am, it crucifies the spirit there, which then it goes into, just as Jesus went into the cave and was reborn Christ, you go into the cave, which would be the fourth ventricle, into the third ventricle, where it hits the pineal gland, where you then become illuminated. And then it's that charged cerebral spinal fluid which then initiates the DMT release from the pineal gland, and then that's when you become Christ. So the story of Jesus's resurrection or death and resurrection is essentially an analogy of our own ascension. That's the way that the mystical traditions encode that sort of sacred truth into myth, into parable, into religious analogy. And what do you think? Do you think that's kind of what happens?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't talk about, you know, that analogy sounds perfect. And so when in our lifetime, what we're actually seeing is spiritual, mystical truths, right, that people have known, that people have experienced, self-knowledge, direct experience, right? When that correlates with scientific studies, when that correlates with scientific expression, you know, you look at meditation and mindfulness now, right? I mean, these are things that Buddhists have been practicing, you know, and they're saying, you're going to do what? You're going to study it? But what happened, right? We needed to put people under fMRI machines and EEGs, and, you know, the cover of Time magazine with the monk with a thousand things. Oh, his left frontal cortex is lit. It's the highest thing I've ever seen. It's like, well, this is what we do. Like, you know, that's why I love it, because those spiritual traditions have there's a knowledge in it that's in the practice, right? Mm. And that is a direct experience. What you described is a direct experience of somebody, of others who have actually put it together and said, wow, all this stuff makes sense, right? Kind of correlates. And now here's this guy who's talking about this fluid, and that now correlates too. So, you know, I'm just showing, so now when you're doing that, how does it feel with you just making being aware of this fluid, right? For me, it's sort of like this, it's this totally omnipotent ground, right? And then in essence, it's almost like a bridge. Like I can use this cerebrospinal fluid. So that's why I bring people into the cerebrospinal fluid, because if that energy is there, then I can actually use it as a bridge to, like you said, go to the other realm, right? I can actually use that. So now I'm here, and then I can try to, I'm actually practicing going into the other realm because I'm in the fluid and I'm actually in direct contact with that energy. So it's sort of a bridge that you can use. So, you know, your description of it, to me sounds spot on. Like, and that's exactly, you know, everybody has their own, you know, everybody has their own experience, which is why on my website, I really try to get people's experiences, because you can't argue with people's experiences. And you know, it's like, look, this is what happened. Like, this is what happened to me. And so one of the things that, that I have a cerebrospinal fluid heart meditation. It's a CSF heart meditation. And what I do is I take people kind of similarly, but you become, you know, you go into your fluid, you go into your third eye. I have an easy time going right into my third ventricle. If you have an easier time going up your sacrum, and now that I'm talking about it, I might do that as well, where you actually enter through your sacrum and kind of go up your spine. But I have an easier time just going right into my third ventricle and going down. So, you know, I go into my third ventricle, I go down to my heart, and at the level of the heart, I stop in my fluid. So I'm in my fluid at the level of the heart, and I connect with my heart, right? So I connect with that beating, and I connect with the electromagnetic field of the heart, like the work that like heart math does, and coherence, right? And resonance and stuff. And I connect with that, and I do the cyclical breathings, but I'm in the fluid, right? So I'm in the cerebrospinal fluid, like a molecule in the cerebrospinal fluid, right? And I'm connecting with my beating heart. I'm connecting with the resonance of my heart. I'm connecting with that coherence. And then when I feel my heart, when I feel that connection, it's sort of like the perfect connection of the vertical. Here I am in this, right? Fluid going all the way down my sacrum. Horizontal, the heart is just spreading out, right? I take my gaze from the level of the, from the perception of the cerebrospinal fluid, I take my gaze and I just glance up. So I do this. And I look all the way up my spinal cord, the central canal. I look all the way up the third ventricle, there through the fourth ventricle, into the fourth, into the third ventricle. And then all of a sudden, it's exactly like you talked about. This illumination just arises. It's like, and I sit, and essentially I'm sitting there, bathed in the energetic potential of my heart, in the fluid. As I'm gazing up, all the way up, you know, is that what you're talking about? You know,
yeah, right. Fuck, Mauro. The prophet has returned.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that's next level, and that really is what I believe to be the root of most mystical experiences. Self-induced. I think if it's a little bit different, if you're going to have a mystical experience, if it was something to do more of a through the consumption of some entheogenic substance, I think that's that sort of process is a little bit different. But in terms of the meditative process, I think that is really what the aim is. And some may be unaware of it, but I really do believe that that's what it is. And that's why I wanted to grab you on here, because I think that's the missing piece that no one talks about, is that's the medium between the energy itself and the release of the DMT from the pineal gland. I think that the cerebral spinal fluid is, that's it. And that's something that I've kind of been thinking about for a while, and just talking to you like it and your sort of confirmation on that, yeah, on my own sort of hypothesis, which is very linked to yours. I think that really is what they've been trying to get at for thousands of years. I think they knew that, and what they did is, instead of just putting it straight up in text, I feel like what they did is was encoded it within stories, within analogies, within parables, metaphors, and so on and so on, so that people with the knowledge that you've got, for example, you would be able to read between the lines and see what they were trying to get at. And it's the path to ascension, essentially. It's the golden path to enlightenment. And if you do this for long enough, then you will begin to reach, heightened states of consciousness. And I feel like that's, I feel like that's something that we're all kind of destined to do. And it just takes a few great minds like yourself, Mauro, to bring this information out there for people to piece together the puzzle for themselves. Because it's, like you said, it's all experience-based. Like, science can only tell you so much from whatever study it is that they've got the funding in order to pursue. But there's some things that science can't tell you, and that they can't tell you what some 100-year-old monk up in the Himalayas in Tibet, what they're experiencing, what sort of break. Like, I'll tell you another thing that's interesting as well, man, is I had one of my friends on called Chris Walton, who's he's a performance psychologist, and he's kind of like the real life Dr. Strange. He's done some crazy shit, and he did an experiment where he was one of these where they got some monks in and hooked them up to an EEG and checked out what was going on. And they noticed the actual brainwave pattern was what they now call gamma. And it's one of those states of consciousness that it's like nearby impossible to reach unless you are like a master meditator. Fuck, that almost come out wrong then. I always said something else. Yeah, a master meditator. Let's put it,
meditator.
Yeah, I had to say that one nice and slow, because I'm sure the other one can get you into some altered states as well. So anyway, the point being is that these monks, these people that have dedicated their life to pursuing these spiritual practices, they can initiate this gamma state of consciousness, which then connects them to essentially the collective whole. And if you look at if you're looking at it on like a monitor, the actual gamma state itself, it's like, it's got like a real high amplitude and it's just real quick and there's so much information that the brain's perceiving, but at the same time, it's a complete calmness. And I feel like that's almost the state that maybe you might induce once you've got the, once you go through that whole process of the Kundalini rising with the release of the DMT, I feel like you get yourself into that gamma state. And yeah, I feel like that's another piece of the puzzle as well.
Totally. Totally. And that's why, you know, it's to me, it's important to remain curious, you know, and to be safe, obviously. And, you know, I always say to, you know, remain grounded too, you know, so all those things are, the direct experience of people, you know, you don't know how many people do lab experiments because they induce states of altered consciousness through lucid dreaming, for instance. You know, these are people who are publishing in Science and Nature. They're trying to get new ideas on how to make, you know, do experiments.
Do you think that's another thing that happens? Do you think that's, because obviously it's hypothesized as well that like the dream state is, again, through the DMT release when we sleep, which probably has something to do.
Yeah, I don't know. That's definitely a theory in terms of different different dreams. I don't know. I definitely know that, you know, you can, I believe that you can tap into different different informational states when you're sleeping or through lucid dreaming or stuff like that. That accesses different ways of consciousness, that access different ways of thinking. And so, you know, if you're having a problem, let's say if you're trying to solve a problem and you're just using your everyday brain, that information from dreams, information from lucid dreaming, information from deep states of meditation that you may tap into, maybe something to, you know, to pursue for experiments. And I do know people who have actually had, you know, Nature publications because of information that they got from lucid dreams. And so, you know, if that resonates with you, try it out.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say then, is like when you're dreaming, is the cerebral spinal fluid interacting with that whole system, or is that literally just the pineal gland that's firing? That's what I'm thinking.
So here's the cool part. So yeah, so you're obviously going into you're obviously going into the pineal gland, DMT. You know, if you talk to we still don't know what the function of DMT is, endogenous DMT is. And I think there, you know, there's people studying it. I do know that exogenous DMT, so if you take it, they've just shown a couple studies that have induced neuroplasticity. So the ability of your brain to be more plastic, in essence, more flexible, create new synapses.
What, from smoking?
Apart
from getting blasted into another dimension, I'm guessing that's why.
Yeah. So it's actually, so it induces neuroplasticity. Then in terms of sleep, the cool part about that is whatever is released. So the pineal gland, we know that the pineal gland, because it's in such high quantities, releases melatonin. Mm-hmm. Melatonin will increase. They've actually done a lot of studies on this, will increase in humans when the sun goes down, because it's actually directly affected based on light perception that's coming through our eyes. To something called the suprachiasmic nucleus. And then that actually goes and it sends information to the pineal gland that can release melatonin. What else is released? I don't know. The problem with DMT is it gets broken down so quickly, right? So it's really hard to study. It's really hard to isolate a fluid and say, oh, there it is, because it can get broken down so quickly. And it may be in small concentrations. And so what happens in sleep too, right, is that, so you're releasing this melatonin, or could you be releasing DMT? I think so, right? Exactly. And then those gates open up, right? Yeah. So now the cerebrospinal fluid, whatever, now the melatonin and DMT possibly is actually in the brain. It's actually in the cerebrospinal fluid, because when you're in a state of sleep, those gates open up, like we were talking about, and the cerebrospinal fluid is going through the brain tissue, cleaning it all out. It's also bringing all its little molecules in there, right? Yeah. So we don't know, like, that's definitely, so now it's going to the entire, now the cerebrospinal fluid is actually signaling, it's in the entire brain, right? So I don't see it as like it stops, right? It's like the gate, if you have a flood, gates are open, it floods, it comes in, and then it stops. Well, that you, during the day, you still then have cerebrospinal fluid, interstitial fluid in the brain. It's just not flowing as quickly, right? So, I think, you know, for people who are interested in their pineal gland, you know, one of the things that I recommend doing is just getting really good at going into your third ventricle for like a guided imagery of your third ventricle and getting a sense. And you may even open up a textbook and look at what does the third ventricle look like? What does the pineal gland look like? What is the shape of the third ventricle? The more you're aware of the anatomy, the more you bring that awareness of the anatomy in with you on a guided visualization. In my experience, and this might not be everybody's experience, but in my experience, the more the tissue is actually going to relate with you. Mm. Like you're gonna recognize it. You're gonna be like, oh, that's you. You're like, hey. All right. And so that's why in those visualizations, what I do is I just say, go into your third ventricle. Be aware of your third ventricle. Just sit in there and look at the spaces, look at the walls on either side, look up, look down, look to the left, look to the right, look forward, look backwards, get a sense of what that is. And then choose on what to go back to your pineal gland. Because if you're in third ventricle, you got to go posterior to hit your pineal gland. You can hit it. If you go in reverse and you're going 60 miles an hour in reverse, you're going to bonk into that thing, right? Go up to it. Say hello to it. See what it does. You'd be fascinated. You'd be fascinated at what it does, you know? Have a conversation with it, you know? Hey, how you doing? You know, go up to the pituitary gland in front. You know, see how it's doing. Kind of cruise around in there. You know, I've done a couple things where I, you know, it's like, it's sort of like you go up to the tissue and it's almost like you're putting your hand out to the tissue and it's almost like you're massaging the most gentle tissue that you could possibly imagine massaging, right? Like coaxing it, right? Like just like saying hello. Like, you are my pineal gland. Oh. Okay. Right? Like, thank you. Thank you for what you do. You're welcome. You know? Almost like, you know, it's like you just, like you're just touching, like, a newborn. Hello. Okay. And then push up again. See what texture you feel. Does it let you push up again? Does it push you back? All those things are actually things that I recommend people try in terms of, you know, getting a sense of their own anatomy and seeing what kind of relationship they actually have with their anatomy, with their own pineal gland, with their own third ventricle. You know, if you go up to your pineal gland and you're sensing that it's pushing you back, what is that? What is that about? You know, all those sorts of things would be important. And then, once you develop that relationship, then you can kind of go and do your own, let's say, investigation of endogenous release of specific things, right? Like, okay, the question would be, can I actively, volitionally secrete DMT from my pineal gland? Or is it just something that I need to sleep or do this or do that? Or is it just constantly going and we haven't found it yet? You know, we don't know the answers to that. Mm-hmm. Can I induce it? Right? I'm not going to give you the answer to that. You go investigate it.
Yeah.
Right?
That's good. Yeah, it's true. That's where you get your, like you that's said, it. Your that's experience.
You, right? And you come, you're like, dude, this is what, you know. And then what happens when you do that? What happens, right? What happens for you? Not what happens for me. What happens for you?
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a whole, you know, like we don't. It's going to be fascinating looking at all these, you know, seeing how not only, you know, I believe even things like MDMA is being fast tracked by the FDA for PTSD. I mean, I see a lot of PTSD. You know, it's scary.
Mm.
You know, we don't have treatments. We don't have good treatments for it. And so if something like MDMA can help these vets, man, they need help. You know, somebody needs help. And if psilocybe is able to help with depression or with end of life anxiety or existential suffering at the end of life, you know, or even just helping people connect to a greater sense of well-being, you know. And I know there's clinics that have been now FDA cleared for some psilocybin studies as well. You know, it's becoming more in our consciousness in the legal world, in essence. And so it'd be interesting how all that pans out.
Yeah, for sure, man. And yeah, I really enjoyed it today, Mar. I really enjoyed your description of everything and linking it together and helping me piece together some of the puzzle again in my mind, because I had a idea coming into this what my idea was on all of this, and having you break it down bit by bit really helped confirm and validate a few things that I've been thinking of as of late in my own sort of hypothesis with this all. But yeah, I appreciate your time, man, and I've had you for a good hour and a half. So we're tying this one up. And just for everyone that's really enjoyed what you're about and they're really intrigued by your work, whereabouts can people keep up to date with the latest from yourself? If you've got your website, you've got any social media presence, YouTube, or where are you the most, apart from the fucking astral realm?
Right now it's going to be at holdingspace.com primarily. So it's going to be www.holdingspace.com. All the new information, whether it's YouTube videos or anything, is going to be there. And then I am in the process of writing a book. You know, I'm in this conundrum, because as information comes out, books are like obsolete. Like it's like, you know, for me to write something now. So I'm just putting stuff on my website now, because I'm not like, to put everything in a book, by the time that book is done, it's like that stuff is dated.
Old.
You know, I've written textbooks for medicine and science. It's like, you know, I submitted a chapter in December of 2018, and the book is going to be published in April of 2020. You know, it's like already obsolete by the time we get there. So I'm having a little bit of sort of, you know, it's like, as, because I just want to get this information out, I'm mostly just as new cool things come out that I find like have a relation to this, I just put it on my web. I've just been mostly putting it on my website as opposed to conglomerating it in a book. But I am, you know, I am sort of working on the book, and as I, you know, as I come up with meditations and stuff, I put those on my website, or I guide you through them on YouTube. And so that's probably right now going to be the best thing. And then I am possibly considering doing some like cerebrospinal fluid training classes, like where you come and learn more about the cerebrospinal fluid and actually palpate brain and really sacrum and start thinking more about the cerebrospinal fluid. So just look out for those. They'll be on my website.
All right. Sound, man. Yeah, that's great. And do the book anyway, Mara, man. That'd be dope. Like, I think you should do it anyway, even if it's dated. Fuck it, whatever. You're still like miles ahead of everyone else anyway with all this. It's like, you're not going to, I think it's going to become that dated. I doubt the fucking, the good people that wrote the Bible were like, shit, guys, this is dated. Let's not put it in here. Fuck. It's going to be out of date within 2 weeks.
I'll take that to heart. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah,
I appreciate that enthusiasm.
Yeah, thanks. For sure, man. Like I said, I'm a big fan of your work, man. You need to get it out there for more people to become aware of this, and hopefully everyone's enjoyed this podcast and enjoyed your side of things. And yeah, definitely look in tomorrow in the future, guys. As for now, that's going to be calling this episode quits. So as always, stay woke as fuck, and I'll catch you on the next episode. Bye.